Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are so many American students failing to learn what they need to know? In a nation with universally free public schools and a stated commitment to education, the shortcomings of our education system are disheartening, and they represent limitations on the futures of millions of young Americans who enter the workforce without the necessary skills to succeed. Hoping to better understand the nature of what students, teachers, and administrators are up against, my guest today offered to spend a year as an unpaid teacher's aide in a poorly rated Connecticut public elementary school in exchange for the chance to observe and document what went on there. Ron Berler is a journalist and editor specializing in children's issues. His new book is called Raising the Curve, A Year Inside One of America's 45,000 Failing Public Schools. We invited him today in honor of Texas Public Schools Week and as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Ron, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
So you were familiar with Brookside Elementary before you spent your really intensive year there. Tell us about the challenges that you knew it was facing even before you started spending 5 days a week.
Well, my wife is the school's speech pathologist, and she had suggested, knowing how I like to work with kids, that I might like to be a mentor for some of the school's troubled children. So about, I guess, 3 or 4 years before I started to research the book, I started spending quite a bit of time at the school. And in that time, I got to meet the principal, many of the teachers, got to know the kids and some of their families, and came to start to wonder about what a failing school is. And I decided I really wanted to take a look at that. I mean, in July 2010, the summer before I started the book, Brookside was one of 19 failing schools in a Norwalk, Connecticut school district consisting of 19 schools. 281 schools in Connecticut that year were failing, 28,000 in the United States. Soon after that, the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, would say that it was possible that 82% of U.S. schools could be failing by the end of the year 2012. It got me thinking, you know, that's a crazy number. What is a failing school? The number now, the 2011 number, the 2012 number is still hard to figure out. The feds don't quite have the number on that. It's now just about 45,000 failing schools. It's not 82%, but it is a huge number. And what I found is that that Brookside, at least, the definition of a failing school is somewhat skewed. It's a good school with good dedicated teachers, but they're faced with a lot of external problems, both cultural and monetary, that are pretty much beyond their control. It's squeezed by, on the one side, by federal and state expectations. On the other side, they have a draconian budget tightening that has been going on for the last several years. All the while, they have to service kids who are disadvantaged by poverty, ethnicity, or family dysfunction. And the school is forced to make a lot of short-term compromises and sometimes act for the benefit of the school and the district rather than for the children first. And yet their kids are moving forward, not as much as we'd like perhaps, but impressive when you look at what they start with.
You know, we cover education often on this show, Ron, and I have to say your book really stands out among the ones that we have discussed in that it is such a nuanced picture of what's wrong. And it also, in some ways, it was one of the most depressing books because it's pretty clear there's not one program, one policy, one genius principal or teacher that can fix this.
You know, that's such a good point you make. It distresses me so when I see reports and people are saying, well, here's the silver bullet. There's no silver bullet. If there were a silver bullet, we would have fixed our education problem a long time ago. And that's what's distressing. I don't think we're You know, if you talk about a silver bullet, you're not talking about education seriously. And it's proof of the fact that it can't be a silver bullet. In the last presidential election, neither candidate really spoke about education. They didn't want to step in that quagmire because they knew they didn't have any way to fix it. There are, you know, some things that you can point to. One thing to me is parents, and we don't discuss this enough, but parents are a huge part of the educational equation. Schools have kids for, what, 6 hours a day. The rest of the time, they are with their families. There was a, and preparing kids and supporting kids, scaffolding their kids is a huge part of how kids get educated. This year, as they do every year, the kindergarten teachers at this school, Brookside Elementary, gave an academic readiness test to their incoming students. And the questions included these: can you count to 10? Can you spell your first name? Can you trace four shapes? And 38% of the incoming kids, there were like seven questions in all, 38% failed in one or more of these areas. This is before they ever walked in the school door. You can't blame the schools or the teachers when 38% of the kids are walking in and they're already behind. That's one thing. Two, the testing has really, the standardized testing has really skewed how we teach. At Brookside, from January 2nd, when kids come back from the Christmas New Year's break, through early March, the standardized test in Connecticut for elementary school kids actually begins today. That's 9 weeks. For those 9 weeks, plus the 2 weeks that these tests go on, these kids drop their curriculum. They stop with their regular learning, with their regular texts, and they pick up study guides that are prepared, designed to converge with the standardized test. It's a study guide like a high school junior would pick up a study guide to study for the SAT, and you're taught to acquire the knowledge of a template. If you answer the question in this manner, you will pass it.
So let me ask you this, Ron, because certainly similar things, I think, happen in a lot of public schools in Texas. The question is, are they helping? Because we know that students are failing to achieve the necessary gains year upon year all over the country. So would their performance be even worse if they didn't spend weeks upon weeks playing drill and kill?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, teach to the test has a horrible connotation. In fact, in its purest form, that's what we should be doing, teaching to the test. I mean, a state curriculum is designed so that the test conforms to the curriculum, so that if you pass the test, that means you've mastered your curriculum. The problem is when you do it to the extent where you eliminate some of your subjects from being taught much at all or almost any at all. At Brookside, once you got to January 2nd, kids were, fifth graders took science, third and fourth graders did not on the test. So the third and fourth graders dumped science.
For nine weeks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And pretty much. You'd have it maybe once a week. You'd be taught maybe once a week. And social studies, civics, dumped in all three grades, except for maybe once or twice a week, because it wasn't on the test. The test itself asked, it ignored things that you would normally expect a child to learn in elementary school years. Grammar, in the writing part of the exam, grammar and spelling are not important. What's important is, you know, that you can form a cogent idea and write a story around one idea. So teachers really, at this school, don't teach grammar or spelling because it doesn't show up on the test. It changes the way we teach in elemental ways. And what kids don't understand in this school is that these grades that they get on these exams don't even go on the report card. I mean, they think it does. The scores don't. They are scored for the benefit of the district and the school. And so basically you're teaching for the test to benefit the teachers and the school and not the students.
And even when the students make gains, one of the teachers laments the fact that, so if you have a student who's, say, two full grades behind in something like reading, and that student comes up so that she's only a semester behind, she's still failing the test, and therefore it almost doesn't count that progress.
That's right. That's why a lot of states, including Connecticut, have finally gotten waivers from No Child Left Behind. And it was exactly that. You would have a fifth grade teacher who would have a kid come in at a high second grade level, which in this school was not that uncommon, and maybe lift that kid all the way up to, say, mid-fourth grade. That's a huge leap. But the test is on fifth grade skills, and that student would fail. Now, the student wouldn't be the only one to fail. The teacher would be judged as failing as well, because that teacher did not bring that child or that group of children to a passing rate.
Yeah, it makes you wonder why, and I'm thankful that there are so many who are willing to do it, but if one is a teacher, why you wouldn't just run for the wealthiest suburban school district you could find so that you don't have to worry about these problems?
Well, you know, there's only so many jobs in Brookside, which is...
But you know what I'm saying? They're unfairly penalized in some ways.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But what I was going to say is that the job competition anywhere outside of a really urban school district is intense. There was one job open at Brookside last year, and more than 400 applied.
Hmm.
You know, the principal of the school, who is 2 years from retirement, and he has always led schools. He's led three schools that all have been troubled schools, and he has lifted them all. Maybe not as much as No Child Left Behind demands, but he's taken them a good far step. And every once in a while, he told me, he will go through a state employment guide where, you know, it lists openings for Connecticut principals. And he'd go, and he'd look at a school that was in a, as you say, a wealthy white district, and he'd go, you know, I wonder what it would be like to teach in a school where passing the test isn't even an issue, where 95% of the kids pass. You know, I wonder, their kids are you know that they're already self-motivated, and in many cases their parents are helping to motivate them as well. And he said, you know, I wonder what would happen if their teachers didn't show up. And he thought, you know, in my school at Brookside, our teachers have to show up. And it takes a certain kind of teacher willing to take that challenge on. And while I saw good teachers and bad teachers and mediocre teachers, I never saw one who didn't try, who didn't give it his or her best.
My guest is journalist Ron Berler. His new book is called Raising the Curve, A Year Inside One of America's 45,000 Failing Public Schools. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ron Berler. He's a journalist and editor specializing in children's issues. His new book is called Raising the Curve, A Year Inside One of America's 45,000 Failing Public Schools. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So, Ron, you spent most of your year in the fifth grade classroom of a very dynamic teacher named Mr. Morey. And on the first day, as he's looking around at his students, the question in his mind is, which of these kids wants to be here?
Yeah. It's a difficult task. In this school is far from a wealthy school. It is 57% Hispanic, 21% white, 18% black, 59% are impoverished to the point where they qualify for reduced fee or free lunches. A number of the kids, including one of the boys that I mentor, has parents, and neither of them speak English. Kids like that, they go through their entire school careers never once being able to go to their parents and say, Mom, Dad, can you help me with my homework? Because they can't. They can't read. And so he is looking out upon a group of children. Mr. Hay, the principal, doubts that more than two parents in the entire school of 500 make $100,000 a year. The culture of the neighborhoods in which most of these kids live does not point towards celebrating education. The dreams of many of these kids, when they fantasize about where am I going to be when I grow up, it doesn't extend to four-year colleges and grad school, where they think is, gee, maybe I'll go to the community college in town. And that's the type of person that he is forced to inspire. That's what he has.
You can't fault families for being poor or struggling in different ways. But one thing that Morey believes, that it sounds like you've come to believe, is that parents can be faulted for not being involved enough. Some may not have language skills, but they can certainly check to see that their kids are doing the work. And Morey actually, one exasperating day, was having students misbehaving and started asking them, okay, who's got chores at home? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it was a great experiment. This had been a part of a continuing conversation that Mr. Morey and I had been having through the school year, because I couldn't quite understand. I mean, when I went to school, I did my homework. I listened. I went to class. I paid attention. And it always struck me how hard he had to fight for attention. And one day we're sitting in the school library, and they're supposed to be researching a report. And one kid, who was among his most reluctant learners, was just goofing around, talking to kids, going to other websites, not doing his work. And he called them up to the front of the room, and he said, tell me, what responsibilities do you have at home? And the kid looked at him like seven heads. He had seven heads, and he said, well, what do you mean? And Mr. Morey goes, chores. What responsibilities do you have? And the kid looked at him, and he said, I don't have any. And Mr. Morey called up another kid just like that. He didn't have any chores either. Then he called up the best student in his class. And the kid reeled off a bunch of chores. He had to make his bed. He had to clean the dishes. He occasionally even had to clean his room. He then called up a girl who lived in a tough neighborhood, but her parents wanted her to excel. The parents met working, blue-collar jobs at the local ShopRite. They wanted her to be a lawyer. And she worked her butt off. She worked like crazy. She wasn't the naturally smartest kid in the class, but nobody worked harder. She had more chores than anybody. And finally, he brought up an average student who nonetheless tried hard. She had the same chores as the hardworking student. And the correlation was remarkable. If you have a foundation at home. If somebody is teaching you to respect what education means and what it can do for you, you're going to take school a lot more seriously. If you don't, it's left to the teacher. And the teacher has, the year I was there, 22 kids. This year, Mr. Morey has 25 kids. And to tend to 25 kids on so many levels that exceed just learning is, I we're asking an almost impossible task of these people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Hillary who says she's a kindergarten tutor in Arlington. First off, I think my title itself says something. Why do we even need to employ a tutor for kindergarten? Now, I know and recognize learning or other kinds of disabilities. I'm not concerned with that aspect. I see so many kids with nothing wrong, just not getting the material. I ask from time to time, what do you do at home? Have you been working on your stuff with your mom and dad? And they answer, watch TV, and no, I haven't been working on it with mom and dad.
Yeah, I have many experiences like that. I have a kid that I mentor now at Brookside, a younger kid who's in the fourth grade. He gets home from school, and he doesn't do his homework. He waits until his father gets home. I said, well, what do you do between the time when you get home and your father gets there? I sit at the kitchen table. Do you read? No. Do you study in any way? Do you think about school? No. What do you do? I do nothing. Or if they do something, they come home and immediately play video games. They don't even go outside. They come home and play video games. But getting back to the parents, so many times, and the last thing I want to do is have it seem as if this is just a language thing, a Hispanic thing. It's not. It crosses all classes and all ethnicities. A parent will come home at night, maybe after a long day of work. Maybe the parent is beat and just wants to chill out. Maybe you watch a ball game on TV. And all he'll do or she'll do is say to his or her child, hey, did you do the reading that you were assigned? Did you finish your homework? And the kid, whether it's true or not, will say, yeah. And the parent will figure, well, I've done due diligence. And that's the end. They don't help them. Or they'll go all the way and do their kid's homework without explaining the how or the why. And again, that's not good because then the kids don't learn. There are so many ways in which you can kind of fall off the ledge there in parents teaching the importance of learning to their children.
One thing you did find, this was really interesting, Ron, is that although the diverse ethnic and racial mix in the school doesn't seem to be socially an issue for the kids, in terms of parents being involved with the school, it becomes one. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. One of the most heartening things of all was that there were no cliques based on race at that school. Blacks, whites, Hispanics, Asians, everyone sat together. Everyone was friends. That changes when they move to middle school somewhat and more when they go to high school. But it's the parents who are cliquish. There are maybe 110 members of the PTO, the Parent Teacher Organization at Brookside. And of those, around 40 are active. And almost all 40, in fact, almost all 110 are. Most of them are white. All of them are middle class. One of the mothers I talked to, one of the protagonists in my book, is a Hispanic woman who dropped out of school herself in the ninth grade, and then last year returned to school and got her degree, her high school degree, which is really a remarkable thing, I think, with, you know, four kids.
Yeah.
She would think she would be a perfect candidate to join the PTO, but she never wanted to do it because she felt that it was a cliquish, white, middle-class club where she wouldn't be welcome. And in fact, the president of the PTO told me that she had never really done an outreach for Hispanic or black parents, didn't know how to do it, and wondered if I had any ideas for how she could, you know, bring more blacks and Hispanic parents into the mix. And it's not like the PTO shapes policy or anything. What they do is fundraise and put on concerts and events. But if you're a member of the PTO, you have an innate interest in the school. And if you're interested in the school, you'll be interested in your child's education, which is why it's important to open up these PTOs to everyone.
I want to cover one more thing before we start taking. We have many people on the phone who want to talk to you. This is the issue of resources. You write about a really dedicated reading specialist in the school who's seen her hours cut back and cut back. Finally, she's ultimately in like the last year that she'll be at the school. And she's forced to make these incredibly difficult choices between multiple students, all of whom demonstrably could use the extra help. But there simply isn't time and money to give it to all of them.
Right. This is a dedicated teacher named Linda Schaefer who started her career as a classroom teacher but became just infatuated with the idea of teaching children to read. And so she became a literacy specialist. Each year she would take, over the course of the year, maybe 30 kids and work with them individually, intensively. For 16 to 20 weeks at a time, almost half the school year. And she'd take these kids and lift them from being remedial students to where she could release them and they would be back at grade level. The problem is that there were so many of these kids that it was decided that it would be a better use of her time to train teachers in her skills of teaching children to read. And yeah, it worked, but the kids who didn't have Mrs. Schaefer, who couldn't have her, and particularly those kids during the time of the preparation for the standardized test, when she was only able to teach needy third, fourth, and fifth graders, and first and second graders who had needed and depended on her help got nothing at all.
Because they're not tested.
Because they're not tested. That's where you saw the damage, and you saw kids who desperately needed help, who she normally would have helped. She would have been there for them. But because of those 9 weeks, or actually 11 because of the testing weeks, that's a quarter of the year, she couldn't work with any of those children in order for the school to try to pass the test. And in the end, the school, the year I was there, didn't pass the test. Only 67% of the children were deemed proficient when at that year, roughly 89% had to achieve what they call proficiency in order to pass.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Ron Berler is my guest. His new book is called Raising the Curve, A Year Inside One of America's 45,000 Failing Public Schools. Let's go on the phone now to Susan in Dallas. Hello, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Hi, Susan.
All this, now I have like 100 different questions. But, yeah, and every one of your points is true. I guess I'll go back to my original one, which is, what do schools do for, I feel like a lot of kids fall through the cracks, not just people on either end, or basically, I think a lot of times middle kids fall through the cracks. What do schools do for children who finish their tests with 100 and then are left doodling on their papers for the rest of the time because there's not enough resources or they won't advance them per subject, per grade. We're in the Richardson School District. So I have actually two children who fall on either end of the spectrum, so I'm kind of interested in seeing your thoughts on that.
Well, what's interesting is, I think I'm going to answer what you want. When schools teach to the test, they're teaching to that big middle group of the bell curve, you know, because their interest is not the top students, not the lower students. It's how can we pass? How can we get the most kids there? So their teaching is directed to that middle group and toward the kids on the cusp of the lower group who, with some extra scaffolding, they believe might come up and achieve. And in that equation, there are two groups that are really left out in the cold. One are the really remedial kids who have no chance of testing, of passing the test, and so they are not given attention. But the other end, which people don't talk about, are the advanced kids, the bright kids, who clearly are going to pass, and they're not given incentives to move forward because the teachers are all focused on these other children, and that's a great loss.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Boris in Dallas who writes, Finland has the number one school system in the world. Instead of spending money on fancy buildings and materials, they pay their teachers high salaries and have 10 students in each class. What do you think about that, Ron?
Well, 10 students in each class, I think that would be a dream in most schools. And you know, the pay is, it's an interesting thing. Yeah. When you walk into, when a beginning teacher walks into school, that salary is not that much out of line with other professions. It's the ratcheting up of salary is so slow, and that's what disturbs teachers, and that's what makes them leave the profession. But a salary alone doesn't necessarily make a great teacher. There are in Brookside a number of teachers who know everything there is and all the latest techniques on how to teach a child to read or how to teach a child to write or how to solve a math problem. But in elementary school particularly, unless you are able to connect to a child viscerally, you're not going to succeed as a teacher. If you bore a kid in kindergarten or first or second or third grade, you're going to lose him. He won't listen to you. But if you have that kid's back, if that kid knows that you are there for him or her, that you care about him, you will succeed.
Ron Berler is with us. His new book is called Raising the Curve, A Year Inside One of America's 45,000 Failing Public Schools. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking education again today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Our guest this afternoon is Ron Berler, a journalist and author of the book Raising the Curve, A Year Inside One of America's 45,000 Failing Public Schools. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. To read just a bit more, Ron, from Boris's email that we heard before the break, Boris goes on to say, instead of complaining about the parents, how about recognizing that families don't have health care and parents are working multiple jobs to barely survive? How do you expect parents to do more when they can barely keep food on the table?
Boy, that's a tough one. I admire parents who do everything they can for their kids, and you can't do everything. I understand that. But if you can just give 15 minutes a day and read to your child when that child is in first grade and have that child read back to you. Or if you are preparing dinner and your child is just learning to read or having trouble reading, have your child read the recipe. When you go shopping, have your child read the labels of items on the shelves. Reading and learning doesn't only have to be at home. You can incorporate it into everyday things that you do. And through doing that, your kid, almost by osmosis, will pick up not only knowledge, but how much you respect knowledge and how much you want that kid to respect it as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having the show. We've got the problem of too much homework and, well, not too much, but we're gifted with two children who were very bright and they go to a great school. And they seem to not have time for chores, and we fall into the trap that I heard you talk about. But we have just a little bit of time with them every day, and we don't want to, you know, have confrontation about chores when they have so much homework. So the balance is real difficult to strike. Can you talk about that?
Well, you're right. That is a tough balance. I guess your kids, are they in high school? Are your children in high school?
They're in junior high school.
In junior high school, and they have so much homework. I'm not one who believes in busy work. I don't know what kind of homework your kids are getting. I believe that the homework should be toward fresh learning and not by doing, repetitious stuff that they can be getting in class. Hopefully, one of the skills that you can teach your children, and it's an important skill for anybody, is to how do you budget time? You only have so much time in a day. A teacher has to do this too, and any adult has to do it. How do I make best use of my time? I still think that there are ways in which you and your children can intersect so that you can squeeze out a few minutes each day where you can work with them, or they can take a couple of minutes off and maybe the two of you could do chores together. But there must be some way that you can catch a few minutes here and there. And sometimes it's just a parent and a child sharing private time together that's the most valuable at all. And I think that's what you should look for.
One thing that was really inspirational at Brookside was the valiant effort that pretty much everybody you write about made to ensure that these kids were reading and had really compelling, engaging material to read.
Yeah. They don't read Dick and Jane books in Brookside Elementary School. What they do is follow it's not a reading curriculum. It's more of a way in which kids read, and it's based on Columbia University's Teachers College program called the Reading and Writing Workshop Program, in which each kid is encouraged to read at his or her own speed. At the beginning of the class, the teacher will teach a brief mini lesson of maybe 10 or 12 minutes on a particular topic, say plot or theme. And then kids will go and read. They'll each go pick a. Each class has a library of about 200 books, and each child will select a book with the help of the teacher that is at their reading level at that moment. And those kids, if you have 22 kids in the class, they could be reading 22 different books, but they'll all be reading it with the idea of plot or theme or whatever that day's lesson is in mind. And at the end of the period, the teacher will come back and either recap that lesson or, having circulated the room and spotted perhaps a common problem that her students were having, address that problem. And Brookside has had tremendous success with that program. And thousands of schools, actually, around the country who follow that program have had similar success.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sarah in Dallas. Hello, Sarah.
Thanks for taking my call, and I'm so excited to read the book.
Thank you.
My question is, I realize there's a difference between actually learning, hopefully in a dynamic and interesting way, as opposed to just remembering answers to specific questions. Mm-hmm. I have several family members who are teachers, and they have to teach to the test. So my question is, how can they fix that? Why isn't there a way we can create a way to celebrate, as you put it, the Israel teacher or the example you just gave? I mean, how can we make that change?
Well, it's very simple. Cut way back on the testing. I mean, think about this. The 9-year-old students at Brookside, the third graders, they take 9 days of tests spread over 2 weeks. They are tested approximately 9 hours on reading, writing, and math. A high school junior, 8 years older, 17 years old, takes the SAT in 3 hours and 45 minutes on one day. There's something wrong here. The idea of the CMT in Connecticut and No Child Left Behind in general is to judge where, not the students, but to judge where a district and a school are, how they're doing, and what can be done to help improve their weak areas. Well, if you're going to judge a school, shouldn't you judge its finished product? What I would do is test kids in the fifth grade when they graduate from elementary school, and then test them in the eighth grade again when they graduate from middle school. And I would test them 1 hour in reading, 1 hour in writing, 1 hour in math, 1 hour in science, and 1 hour in social studies. That's 5 hours spread over a week. And in that way, no core courses are passed over, and so no courses would not be taught in those prep weeks leading up to the testing. That's what I would do. If you had all that more time, you would have plenty of time to teach your kids creatively.
We were really worried. I mean, a part of the focus of the education reforms that we've seen over the past decade or so have come because many people were concerned at that point that American public schools were failing. Do we have evidence that students are actually learning more, better prepared today than they were before we began to really focus on this testing?
Well, yes and no. Obviously, we know that they can learn to a template because they're doing better on that template. Kids, more children are advancing through their schools along the lines of what they're being tested on. Does this limit them in terms of their general overall liberal arts education? I would think it would. Would it limit their access to science prior to when they get to middle school? I would think they would, just because time of teaching is cut down. So strictly in terms of, are they doing better on the tests? Yes. Are they reaching 100%? No, but they're getting better. But is their overall quality of education getting better? I don't know. I think that they would do better if they had a more broad-based system of education, a more liberal arts based system that allowed more creativity for the teachers. And if you're teaching to the test and your curriculum is based on that test, hopefully a school would trust its own curriculum. That should be good enough. If your curriculum isn't good enough to pass the test, then you need to change your curriculum. But, you know, a good school should be able to keep its curriculum, I would think.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Shannon on the line in Arlington. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay. The problem is this. We can't just blame the whole problem on the teachers.
Right.
But the parents are at fault, the teachers are at fault, and
right.
The principal of the school are at fault. Okay, principal of the school, for example, I myself was a teacher. I've been teaching for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
When you walk into a school, and no offense to anyone, if the principal and assistant principal are black or Spanish, automatically you notice the majority of the teachers are either black or Spanish. So the minority teachers, considering white teachers, they're at a very odd situation. They cannot discipline the students. They cannot be demanding any situation in regard to the students.
Did you find anything like that at Brookside?
Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Sir, what you're saying is out of my realm of experience. And I've never known of a teacher who wouldn't behave according to how the principal would want. And I've never known a school to hire strictly according to whatever race the principal was. That boggles me. I've never heard anything like that. If it exists, I think that's sad, but I've never encountered anything like that.
One interesting strategy that Mr. Morey that you worked with had for dealing with a couple of boys in his class who would otherwise have been pretty problematic was recruiting one of them to sort of act as a leader and essentially making him an ally.
Yeah. The most important thing in a class, if you're going to make it function, is to have it under control. Just one kid can, you know, throw it out of whack. And two or three can really destroy not only one class session, but in some cases of teachers who, you know, really are poor on class management, it can destroy a year. And I've seen that. I've mentored kids who suffered from a teacher who just couldn't control things. Mr. Morey, early on, identified three boys who were troublemakers. And he looked for the one who was the true leader. And Mr. Morey has a way of treating kids with greater maturity than the kids might expect that they would deserve themselves. And when Mr. Morey would ask them to take on responsibility, oftentimes it was the first time an adult had put trust in them, had asked something almost grown up of them. And they responded in a remarkable way. Mr. Hay always said, the principal, Mr. Hay, always said, you know, set the bar high, because if you set the bar for students low, they will go to that low level and stop. But if you set the bar high, they will achieve more than you or they ever dreamed. And Mr. Morey plugged into that, and that's how he treated his kids. He didn't treat them like 10-year-olds. He treated them like 15-year-olds. And this one boy who was ready to accept responsibility did, and actually turned the class around, turned the behavior patterns of the class around.
Ron, we just have about 30 seconds left, but briefly in that time, can you talk about how the school maintains morale even when year after year most can expect that students won't all pass the tests?
They maintain morale because of the teachers and the principal. They have a positive attitude. I was in a class just the other day where the kids were reading a story about a kid who is having trouble socially, and the teacher stopped the story and she said, each of you kids, you know that I will never quit on you, that I will always be there for you. And the kids understood that because she had been like that all year. The kids aren't going to pass the CMT, the standardized test, this year, but they know that their teacher is behind them, and because of that, they're not going to quit either.
Ron Berler's new book is called Raising the Curve, A Year Inside One of America's 45,000 Failing Public Schools. Ron, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download the podcast and learn more about the show at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day. We'll